especially to the MP in your constituency period. Just one house matter. SAA, I think you must know about
that. Minister Kikava approached me to explain that the cabinet Lekhotla next Thursday, and he was keen to come because since we last tried to meet with the SAA, there have been further developments, as you know, through the public coverage of it. And so it seemed to me quite reasonable. Friday is a normal working day in any event. So our meeting on Thursday afternoon is postponed, and we meet on Friday at 9.30 to 13.00. Okay, is that fine? Thank you. I see Irene Taliab here. Just to remind us, she's not a member of Parliament anymore. But welcome. I always mention you, by the way. Some people might say it's a divide-and-rule approach, but I think we all miss your valuable contribution, and we wish you well in wherever you are at the moment. Apart from that, welcome to the Governor and his team. Will introduce themselves. Just to explain, we were with the Reserve Bank in 2014. We came to Tswane, to your offices. We were there in 2015 again. Last year we weren't, and for those members who are relatively new, we rotate because we have so many entities that fall under our portfolio. We rotate. So it was, in any case, Governor, your turn this year. And one of the reasons we didn't call you is because you performed so well overall in managing your annual reports and so on, which we obviously see and our researchers look at. But we are this morning going to first ask the Governor to spell out the overall role of the Reserve Bank, and then the economic outlook for the country, the latest quarterly report and so on, and then finally the annual report. So there are three items, each of which is allocated about half an hour, Governor, and then half an hour questions. That will take us to 1 o'clock. Okay, I'll be on with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. It's good to be back here. We do welcome the fact that you are aware that we are doing so well in our job. And my worry is that the day you call me to come here, I'm going to say, what wrong have I done now? But it is very important that the interactions take place. Of course, you are always welcome to Pretoria, but it's also good for us to appear in the public domain so that accountability could actually
do it once a year. Actually, we did think about it. The committee has discussed the matter that at least once a year, because you're so important, never mind how well or otherwise you perform, we should have you here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I will go through the first two parts of the presentation, but I will do the first part and then we will take the questions, and then I'll do the second part and we'll take questions. Yeah. And then when I get to the annual report, I will split it with the deputy governor. With me, Deputy Governor Minele, Deputy Governor Khruk, and Deputy Governor Naidu. Among the staff here, we have got Jabulani Sakali from the communication. We have got Bulelo Popoana, who is the chief of staff. We have got Leanne Mayer, who is also part of the stakeholder and outreach unit called Leo Mahamate, and we have got Lizel Khadeb also from the same.
To say we're missing Unati because he's been here quite a lot.
Yeah.
With the
so
Twin
Peaks
film.
You will realize that the agenda has got nothing to do with Twin Peaks. And I think that it will be proper that I start by reminding everyone present that the SARB is a creature of the Constitution. And it derives its mandate from Section 224 of the Constitution, which is to protect the value of the currency in the interest of balanced and sustainable growth. Once the Financial Sector Regulations Bill has been signed into law, we will then also formally have a mandate to protect and enhance financial stability in South Africa, which will be in addition to our primary mandate of price stability. I must say that the SARB had been focusing on financial stability as early as 2002. And so we have been doing that implicitly, but what the bill will do is that it will give us legislative power to be able to do financial stability and to take appropriate steps if we believe that financial stability could be threatened. Among our key activities, we regulate and supervise the banking system, and what the FSRB will do is that it will also bring insurance companies into the fold of the Prudential Authority, which will be created within the South African Reserve Bank. We ensure the effective functioning of the national payment system. It's one of these functions that people take for granted, but when you go and you swipe your credit card or you withdraw money from the ATM, behind that is a system that the Reserve Bank is running, which all the banks are tuned into that system. It's the national payment system. It's a very important system. We almost have to run this system in two different buildings so that if anything happens in one building, the other building, the system will continue to run. So it's very important for the effective functioning of the financial system. We undertake economic data analysis and research, and we issue high-quality notes and coins. We manage the official gold and foreign exchange reserves of the country, and we administer the country's remaining exchange control regulations. But more importantly, which people tend to miss, is that we are the banker to the government. But then the one that most people focus in is our responsibility with respect to the protection of the value of the currency. And this falls in the realm of monetary policy. And the question comes, what is the role of a monetary policy? Now, ensuring price stability or low inflation is a traditional function of central banks. All central banks have this as a mandate in some form or another. If not the central bank, who would control inflation? But how do the central banks control inflation differ? And this depends on the framework that different countries adopt in order to control inflation. There are different frameworks. Inflation targeting is one that we currently have in South Africa. Fixed exchange rate systems is another that had been employed historically in Asia, and there are all sorts of stories in Latin America of countries that tried this and failed dismally. We also tried at some stage without having a very explicit exchange rate target, and it cost the country dearly. We had to build a significant forward book to try and defend the level of the currency in foreign exchange market. It didn't work. It cost us dearly. And then lastly, of course, is targeting of monetary aggregates, which is something that was the framework of the Reserve Bank for some time. And when the seventh governor of the Reserve Bank, Dr. Stiles, was asked, why did you abandon monetary aggregates? He said, we didn't abandon monetary aggregates. The monetary aggregates abandoned us. And that's because that it was never clear to the public what the Reserve Bank is actually trying to do. So today the Reserve Bank is talking about money supply, tomorrow is talking about credit extension, and it talked about all sorts of monetary aggregates. And the monetary policy framework was that not transparent for the players to actually understand. It is therefore monetary policy, cannot determine the long-run growth potential in the economy. It affects growth, but it affects growth only on the cycle. So then it therefore goes that monetary policy cannot solve the problem of structural unemployment in the economy. Monetary policy should therefore focus on what it can do and not what we would like it to do. Many of the sub-functions have a socio-economic impact. The sub itself is a public institution, and as such, what we do is in the interest of the economic well-being of South Africans. But why should we be having a low inflation? High inflation has got a negative redistributive effect. The poor are least able to protect themselves, and inflation reduces the purchasing power of wages, savings, and social pensions. The wealthy have various means to hedge themselves. And even if you are not wealthy and you are a worker, if you belong to a powerful trade union, you could always negotiate your wages such that they are protected from the ravages of inflation. But if you are weak and vulnerable and you are not in an organized formation, you do not have that bargaining power. Neither do you have information to constantly be searching to see how you could actually protect yourself. So if anything, countries with high inflation rates have got very skewed distributions of income. So high inflation creates uncertainty about the future, and it adversely affects investment and consequently growth and employment creation. Low inflation provides a stable environment for investment and therefore for long-term growth and investment. Low inflation also impacts this thing here says low inflation also impacts negatively on the country's international competitiveness. It's the other way around. It's high inflation also impacts negatively on the country's international competitiveness. Otherwise, we should have said low inflation also impacts positively on the country's international competitiveness. In a high inflation environment, savers and lenders will require high nominal interest rates to induce them to save and to lend. That is why we see that countries with high inflation have high nominal interest rates to compensate for higher inflation. Low inflation allows for low interest rates and more investment and growth. And later on, I will show slides that show the different episodes of interest rates and inflation in South Africa. And the evidence is just compelling. Just shows you that when you have low inflation, you can afford to have low interest rates. Currently, South Africa's real and nominal interest rates are at near long-term lows due to the relatively low inflation environment. And this table, table one, shows inflation and policy rates in South Africa and selected advanced economies. I will not go through the entire table, but what the table just shows is that you can see countries in the developed world had inflation averaging below 2% in 2014 to 2016, and in 2017, although the inflation was marginally higher, it is still in the low and below 3%. Let's look at the policy rates. When you look at the policy rates for those periods, you can see in some instances the policy rates even ended up having to be negative. That is what it meant, having low inflation. Before I get accused of being told that, but South Africa is not as developed with as those countries, let us look at the emerging market countries. Table 2 shows the inflation and policy rates of South Africa in selected emerging market countries. Once again, you can see it's a similar story. Countries with low inflation have got low policy rates. So if there is anyone craving for lower interest rates, such people should be the supporters of bringing inflation down, because that's the only way you are going to have lower interest rates in the future. And table 3 looks at South Africa itself. In the 1990s, crime rate was 18.9% on average. The inflation rate was 9.9%, which meant that real crime was 9%. GDP growth was only 1.4%. Let's go to the 2000s, which incidentally coincide with South Africa introducing inflation targeting. The inflation rate came down on average to 6.8%, prime rate came down to 13.2%, and the real prime rate came to 6.4%, and growth averaged 3.6%. From 2010 to now, Prime rate has averaged 9.4%. Why? Because inflation was averaging 5.4%, and real prime rate was 4%, and real growth, GDP growth, was 2%, in spite of us having been impacted by the global financial crisis and suffering from the after effects from that crisis of the after effects of 2008. Table 4 shows the comparative inflation target of the various countries, and it actually shows that once again, I mean, the country that we like comparing ourselves to, which is Brazil, since 1990, if you took the average inflation rate in Brazil, it would have been 316%. Since they introduced inflation targeting, it averaged 6.7%. And since the global crisis, it averages 6.8%. You can go through this whole table, you would see that as countries introduce frameworks that are credible, that everyone can attest to and are transparent about it, that they experience lower inflation and thus lower interest rate. Table 5 shows the inflation targets of various countries. Here Brazil has it as 4.5% plus minus 2%, which means that the upper band is 6.5, the lower band is 2.5%. Just 3 weeks ago, Brazil announced that they are revising their inflation target lower to 4%. It basically means that competitively, when you look at South Africa and Brazil, Brazil becomes more competitive than we are if they realize their inflation target. Actually, the most recent reading in Brazil is 3.6 about. So that just shows the various countries and when they adopted this inflation target. Let me move to the other matter, which is important and which central banks, and particularly central banks of the developed world, only really started worrying about in 2008. But our central bank started worrying about the issues of financial stability in 2001-2002. It was not because we were just geniuses. We got our own wake-up call in 2002 because we had a mini banking crisis in 2002. We had a lot of A2 banks closing down. Some of them voluntarily surrendered their licenses. And from that time, the Reserve Bank decided to pay particular attention to the issue of financial stability, even when we didn't have the tools, the full toolkit to maintain financial stability. 10 years after the global financial crisis, only now are the advanced economies showing signs of sustained recovery, and a full recovery is still not assured. So, regulating and supervising banks is part of the financial stability mandate, and this involves ensuring that banks do not undertake excessively risky lending. Bank failure can also have negative impacts on the economy and on depositors in general. And let me be clear. The public policy objective of regulating banks is not to protect banks from failure, but to enable banks to fail without causing disruptions to economic activity. The ultimate objective is to protect the depositors and policy holders. That is the focus. All of these other things are subsidiary. And the reason is very simple. If there are no savers, there will be no borrowers, because who would they borrow from? And that is why you must protect savers, because once savers run away from the financial system, there will be no lending that is going to take place. So a bank failure could have systematic risk through causing general panic among depositors who will withdraw their deposits, as well as through interlinkages between institutions. And this can cause collapse of otherwise healthy banks. Regulation and supervision helps maintain trust and confidence in the banking sector. And sometimes when the banks have temporary problems, the central bank steps in as a lender of last resort to banks with a liquidity problem, thereby helping to protect the banking system from systematic banking crisis. So, as it happens, the manner in which we run the banking system is the way in which we can influence interest rates is to ensure that the banking system has a shortage of funds and has to come to the central bank for borrowing. And so they would then end up having to borrow from the central bank, and thus the central bank rate becomes the benchmark for all the other borrowers in the market. So financial stability is important because we need to protect the depositors of the bank and the broader economy. As has been seen from the African bank saga, it does not protect shareholders. It protects shareholders because shareholders are supposed to be watching. The depositors do not have the wherewithal to be watching the ins and outs of what is actually happening in a bank. And that is why the public policy objective of financial regulation is to protect the depositors. Well, that deals with the mandates of the bank. Well, someone said that the Reserve Bank is an anomaly because we have private shareholders. But private shareholding is an historical legacy. Let me just spend a few seconds and say that when the Reserve Bank was created, it was in the aftermath of the 1918-1919 banking crisis in South Africa, when every single bank issued its own notes. And the notes had to compete, well, they were backed up by gold somehow. But after that banking crisis, the world over there started to be a move that said, no, we can't trust these bankers. We must create a central bank. And the central bank was created. And when it was created with private shareholders, including the bank, but there was a restriction about how much shareholding can be held, and everyone was limited to 10,000 shares. But also there was another important issue. It was, you're going to create this bank, where is it going to get capital from? Which is why it ended up issuing shares. What subsequently happened is that a number of central banks got nationalized, sometimes for good reasons, but many times not for good reasons, because it entailed wanting to grab the control of the central bank. The German central bank, when it was nationalized, it was in the aftermath of what happened in Germany, and it was, we can't trust these other fellows, let us have this thing nationalized. We are one of only 9 central banks that are still having a private shareholding. Private shareholders do not own the stock. They have shareholding, but they don't own the stock. And their rights are actually limited. They play no role whatsoever in the setting of or influencing the key mandates of the bank, be it monetary policy or financial stability. They have got no sway over the day-to-day management of the SAP, and they are restricted to a maximum of 10,000 shares, including the associates of those shareholders, out of 2 million issued shares. Shareholders receive a fixed return on their share of 10 cents per share from profit made. This amounts to an overall dividend payment by the bank of 200,000 rand per year. 90% of the profits are then transferred to government, and the remaining 10% are allocated to the staff as reserves. The private shareholders do not have any claim on the foreign exchange reserves of the bank. The reserves belong to the country. And private shareholders are unable, by means of a resolution or otherwise, to amend or change the SAP's affairs by deviating from the prescriptions of the South African Reserve Bank Act. In terms of the Reserve Bank Act, shareholders can approve, they have got the power to approve the appointment of auditors by the SAP and their remuneration. They elect non-executive directors to the board from a vetted list. The other 8 are appointed by the president. And this includes the governor and the 3 deputies. Private shareholders represent an additional layer in the governance framework of the SAP by strengthening accountability and transparency. But what is the role of the sub-board where the shareholders are having people who they had elected? The board itself is a corporate governance board and has no input or say in the policies related to the sub's mandate and primary functions. The board's functions are limited to corporate governance issues, such as internal controls, including auditing, sub-policies, and remuneration. The management of the business of the bank vests with the governor and the deputies, and they are all appointed by the president. So this concludes the first part of the presentation on the mandate of the sub and the role that we play, and I think that it would be useful that we pause and take questions.
Okay, thank you, Governor. Questions, please, comments from members? Mr. Mania? Floyd? Okay, go for it.
Thank you, Chair. I have a couple of questions. Governor, I mean, I think it's self-evident to everybody in South Africa that as the governing party faces a political crisis and electoral defeat, it's starting to scapegoat, in the first instance, the private sector, the banks, and now the South African Reserve Bank. And to your credit during this time, you have certainly robustly defended the bank. If I look at your replying affidavit, you call the public protector reckless. You say that she, in respect of the matter, has a clear lack of understanding of the Constitution, that her remedial action is an abuse of power, and that her remedial action exposes her own lack of competency, which I think is a kind way of saying that on this matter, you regard the public protector as incompetent, all of which I agree with. But the question here is not so much the role of the Reserve Bank, but the role of the minister. If you contrast your robust defense of the bank within 24 hours, a statement, within 8 days, papers lodged. If you compare that with the minister, who for 16 days dithered on this matter and only lodged papers 16 days after the remedial action was first made public by the public protector. So my question on this is, was there any interaction between yourself and the minister, or between yourself and the minister's advisor on this matter, and what was the nature of that interaction? So that's on the question of the mandate. On the question of private shareholding of the bank, I mean, I've noted that you had a robust defense of the bank's mandate, but your intervention on the question of the private shareholding is much more subdued. If I look at your statement at the recent AGM, you say that there's no obvious case for changing the state of affairs at present. It's not clear to me what your position is on the whole question of the private shareholding of the bank. Do you support it, or do you oppose it? So I think we need to be absolutely clear on what your position is in respect to private shareholding. Then the whole question of the undue influence of private shareholders before 2010. Now, in a reply to a question, a parliamentary question in March, you concede, and I'd like to quote, that the Saab at times in the past, before 2010, experienced deliberate attempts at circumventing these legislations, that's the 10,000 shares per shareholder. Individual persons, by utilizing the names of minors, relatives, and friends or other persons under their influence, accumulated unduly large numbers of Saab shares under their control. This resulted in undue concentration of Saab shares under the ultimate control of a single person who could potentially utilize the commensurate number of votes under their control to exercise undue influence on the SOP. Now, if you look at the total amount of shares that were disposed of earlier in the year, you can conclude that there were possibly 15 odd individuals who had engaged or tried to engage in the undue influence of the SOC. Now, up until now, you have refused to disclose the names of the 15 individuals that engaged in this practice. And so I put it to you, what are the names of the 15 shareholders that allegedly engaged in trying to unduly influence the SOP? Again, on the question of private shareholding, are there any private shareholders of the bank who are currently applying for banking licenses? And if there are, what are their names, and do you think that the practice of a private shareholder applying for a license, do you think that there's any conflict of interest, and whether this practice is wise? Again, on private shareholding, I see that at the AGM, the previous AGM, not the most recent AGM, Mr. Ben Kruger thanked the SAAB on behalf of the shareholders. But in your shareholding register, Mr. Ben Kruger and Standard Bank do not appear to be shareholders of in the bank. Again, on private shareholding, you notice that private shareholders may not hold more than 10,000 shares. But your own shareholding register reflects that SA Mutual Life Assurance Society owns 20,000 shares. How is that possible? And then finally, on a different matter, whether the SAAB's financial surveillance department has at any time investigated alleged contraventions of exchange control regulations, and whether that investigation has been completed, and what are the findings of that investigation. Thank you.
Your last question, I didn't follow it. Are you talking about any specific case or in general?
My understanding is that the Reserve Bank have investigated alleged exchange control violations by the Gupta family, in respect of particularly VR Laser and the Danel matter, and also in respect possibly of comics. In fact, a matter of public record. The question here is, has the investigation been finalized, and what were the findings of the investigation, and possibly the subsequent action that the SAAB may have taken on the basis of that report?
Yeah, that's about specific cases.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fair question to ask. I can predict the answer, and we will have to decide as Parliament what we do. This matter has come up before with the South African Revenue Service Governor. We are not happy as a committee that these things, I mean, the peasants in Mongolia, they know about the Gupta allegations, right? Billions and billions of rands are disappearing, and Parliament keeps coming against this matter, that SARS will say, well, we can't discuss specific cases. I can anticipate what you're going to say, and we respect that. Parliament must decide what it can do. One of the options that we are thinking about to remind members, and I think we need to speak to, will the two of you speak to Frank? He's not here. We want to know whether we can't discuss these things. Is Frank here? We started work on that with SARS. Okay, let's hear what the governor says, and then we will also decide on SARS, okay? Because Parliament can't sit back lamely and do nothing. Yes, thank you.
thank you, Chairperson. So, Governor, I think I agree with the Chair's proposal that the Reserve Bank Governor must come and give annual reports and reflections here in the Standing Committee on Finance, and then take it from the, perhaps the timing of it could be determine whether it should be before the publication or the release of the annual report or just immediately after. We can then look into how we deal with that. But it should be a constant engagement so that we know what is happening. More so now when the bank is going to have the prudential authority. The governor, you are highlighting that the private shareholders do not own the South African Reserve Bank. Who owns the Reserve Bank if they do not own it? Is it ownerless? Is it ownerless? Like, because you can't say they do not own, but the shareholders in many instances are those that own. Maybe their ownership in terms of legislation might not be that impactful, like as you're saying that they do not play any role whatsoever in the setting of and influencing the key mandate of the Reserve Bank. It's one of the things that so basically what this means is that to have shares of the Reserve Bank is a vanity project. It's like a vanity exercise in if this is a reflection of reality. So let's abolish that vanity. Chair, I think that you've got mandate, all of you, to discontinue the private shareholders in the Reserve Bank. And then we should nationalize the Reserve Bank, but we should guarantee its autonomy. And that is what we said as well when we're celebrating the fourth birthday of the EFF, that let us discontinue these vanity exercises of people who own shares but do not have any significant say in terms of the direction of the bank, but also do not necessarily own the bank as is presented here. So if that is the case, I don't think that we could deal with that. It's one of the things that we can actually even find more clearer and much more categorical mechanisms to guarantee its autonomy so that it's not utilized for sometimes narrow purposes in a way that could be. The second issue I want to deal with is what other assets does the bank own? I know that when there was an intervention in African Bank, I think the Reserve Bank ended up being an owner. Maybe we'll clarify that an owner of 50% of the African Bank and PIC owning 25% and the other banks owning 25% of the African Bank. So what other assets does the SARB own? And what is the value of that? There is talk every time, like when we went to the Bank of England in this oversight visit, so there was an allegation or a remark that the gold, like the physical gold, that a lot of it that is in the Bank of England, some of it is South African gold. Is that the case? Do you take gold bars to the Bank of England or to wherever? Where is our gold? Where is South Africa's gold, which was dug by the sweat and blood of African laborers who were paid nothing? And that is one thing that must be clarified as well. The second last issue is, why hasn't the Reserve Bank created a conducive environment for existence of other banks other than the four or five that are existing now? When we're dealing with the financial sector transformation, for instance, coming to the realization that in actual real ownership, outside of the pension funds and the foreign investors, black people's participation in terms of being the owners of banks is less than 5%. So that is outside of the pension funds or the mandated funds and outside of the foreign investors. There isn't significant and meaningful black participation or even state participation in the ownership. Why haven't you created an environment for other role players, particularly those that constitute the majority in South Africa owning these financial institutions? And then the last question is, what has been your role practically in dealing with the illicit financial flows? There are so many reports that come every day that people are shifting billions of rands. And the Reserve Bank has a role in the movement of money from South Africa to other parts of the world. What have you done about it? Why is it not being abated? Like many illustrations, the illustrations of the amount of money which is leaving our country, it's massive. What is the bank doing? Are you spectating when people are taking our monies to Dubai? Are you spectating when the tax base is being eroded in a spectacular way? Maybe we need to be given an update, and there is one update that we should get more constantly, because I think there's an issue which we said we must problematize, Chair, of that secrecy which SARS talks about every day when we want to get accountability on how are they dealing with the taxation collection. So that is one of the things that we need to be given clarity on. Maybe we'll come back later. Thank you.
Want to say anything from the members? No. Can I just say a few quick things? One is, Governor, it may interest you to know, presumably you know this already. When we were there 18 months ago in England, we met the Bank of England, as Floyd says. And it's very interesting, we went to the museum there, and they're very remarkably erudite and charming and, you know, engaging lady said to us, immediately we went to, she said, what are you doing here? You have one of the best reserve banks in the world, you know, and so what can you learn from us? Of course, she was half serious, but half facetious, but, you know, repeatedly in exchanges, especially outside of formal meetings when you're chatting over tea, what comes across is the enormous respect people have for the Reserve Bank of our country. I just mentioned that because it was prompted by what Floyd says. And of course, I've forgotten what Floyd said. In fact, he had, and one or two other members raised the same issue. Excuse me, what? We were there, excuse me. Now, on the role of the bank, it seems to me, to oversimplify it, there's two strands of thinking about the bank needing to review its role, right? The one represents actually not even a class, a small strata within a class, an emerging strata, whose interests are about me-me-meism. All they want is to subvert institutions of the state to their narrow, selfish, elitist interests without any care for the poor and disadvantaged. Now, while we should guard against that, there's also been, as you well know, Governor, in the many roles you've played, and no doubt in different roles you've played, you might have helped to shape some of these ideas too, that actually, while all that you say about the bank's role is correct, you know, about the currency, financial stability, increasingly with the FSR bill, there is a space, it's argued by people on the so-called left and other temperate people, you know them better than I, this is more your area than mine personally, who say that the bank can play some role in broader issues of growth and development and job creation. Sometimes people refer to the U.S. Central Bank in that regard. Now, obviously, nobody would suggest that the role of the bank, you say, for example, therefore cannot solve the problem of structural unemployment in economy. Presumably bending the stick in extreme direction. Nobody's going to say that the complex problems of structural unemployment can be resolved by the bank expanding its role. And so what I'm saying in short, do you dismiss, there are those who want to substitute a new role for the bank, right? The others are saying, no, the role it currently has is fine, but it has to include other things as well around growth and development and jobs. And so firstly, are there no other central banks, in your view, that do this, not least the Bank of the United States, Central Bank? Do you dismiss it altogether? In other words, what I'm saying is it not time we also looked at the role of the Reserve Bank? We need to look at the role of Parliament, the role of government. We're in a situation where there's no easy way out. So we shouldn't, I think, because there are nefarious forces out there, who for the wrong reasons want the bank's role to be emasculated. We're not saying that. We're saying retain what you have. You get the drift. But can't you add to it in a moderate, temperate way? incrementally, let's see what can be done.
Would you dismiss it altogether, and why do you feel what you do?
Then you're acutely aware, Governor, even more than some of us here, how untransformed, as much as been a lot of progress, we agree. I think the majority in the committee's view is there has been progress, of course, since the mid-90s in transforming the financial sector. But it's nowhere near as transformed as it should be. And the high levels of monopoly and so on. We're about to finalize our report based on the public hearings we've had. You have seen also the governing party raising this at its recent policy conference, the minister himself being more strident than perhaps previous ministers have been around this. So this is an issue on the agenda. Now the question that arises is the bank got any role to play in this regard? I don't know whether you have a view or whether you can, given your role, utter a view on this, but the fact that four banks own over 90% of the market, do you think that's something that's acceptable, reasonable, given our circumstances? We want to thank you, by the way. The Reserve Bank was here at all the hearings, and you also made formal submissions. I think Kuben was here, right? We heard you, and we're looking, the draft is about to be ready. In the next week, it will be distributed to members to look at, also, with next week or so, let me say. Then, on the matter of illicit financial flows, this is a perennial preoccupation of this committee. We're working with Trade and Industry and Minerals and Energy, and sometimes with a larger group. Now, we have the Reserve Bank here, as with SARS and Treasury and so on. But I think the consensual view across all parties is that not enough is being done. You see, even if one-tenth of the allegations are accurate about the billions that are leaving this country, it is horrific. It's obscene. It's barbaric, actually. And you are such a good Reserve Bank, so we are told. And that's the one thing that niggles me, and I'm sure many of the other members here. It is obscene. It really makes one's blood boil, actually. I don't know how else can I put it. So what is going on? We are reaching the end of our tether on this matter, so we're going to tell you what we're thinking about. We're now looking, we've asked our lawyer, Advocate Jenkins, can we have this thing rounded up in the next week or so? We are looking into the possibility of calling SARS and, where appropriate, other institutions that are relevant, separately, yourselves included, the Reserve Bank, to a closed meeting. The Intelligence Committee operates like that. So I can't see why we can't say, so-and-so is accused. And we can call so-and-so there. Let them be there too, so that no misrepresentations, either wittingly or unwittingly, can occur. Now, last time we were told by a member of this committee, I can't recall, maybe it was a DA member, that there are 5,000 allegation cases presented to the criminal justice system, the SAPS, the Hawks, and so on. And so it is that we decided that we'll call them here to ask them, what are they doing? We're not so interested anymore, Governor, on the theory and the strategy. We can always sharpen that. But we're not technical experts. We're Parliament. We want to see action. We want to see some of the names in the public domain appear in the court system. They must, if they are innocent, then the court system must acquit them. What can you do as the Reserve Bank more than you are doing to ensure that this happens? I think it's a tough question on you, but I think we really fed up now, to put it mildly. And so, you know, we really want drastic action, and we want expert legal advice, and we must, as Parliament, go to the highest authority, the Speaker, and if need be, we must look into legislative and constitutional changes. We cannot carry on like this. I'm choosing the words carefully for the media that's here. Now, tomorrow they might have nothing else to say. They'll say, Parliament's going to go to... We're saying we're exploring all these possibilities. Let me stress, I'm not a lawyer. We want to do it in a temperate, sensible, legal, constitutionally sound way. There's so many words there, so hopefully you won't use reference to this because it's too long a sentence, right? But that's what I've said. Can you minute that carefully, Thabo? Because I'm tired of the crude misrepresentation. Okay, let me not engage with the media. Because you're our ally in this thing for the most part. Having said that, can we hand over to you?
Thank you very much. You don't have to kick an open door, Mr. Chairman. Quite a rich question. On the illicit flows, I'm going to give that a shot, and then I will ask Kuben Naidoo to talk about it, just so that I can give him a frame so that he knows how far he can go or not go. So whilst he's collecting it, so let me deal with the questions that has come, because one of the things you have said you wanted us about the public protector. I am busy checking whether the lawyers are not coming back to me to say this is how the court has ruled, because the matter is sitting in the court now. Yeah, it's sitting in the court now. So it's difficult for me to say. Suffice to say that, yes, there was interaction immediately on the day that it was the public protector released the thing. And I must say, as I had stated in the affidavit, when we were actually sitting in an ESCO when somebody says the public protector has just made this announcement, and we asked for the report, and the report only reached us at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and by that time the market had tanked. Right, so we were basically fighting with our hands tied behind our back because we didn't know how to respond because we didn't have the report. The report was only delivered after the press conference, and it was not a helpful way of dealing with a matter of this matter in this respect. I think to be fair to the minister, when the report came, the minister had been in for a few weeks in office, and he was actually traveling. Be that as it may, we suspected in December when the first report, the draft report, was leaked, that this matter is going to be handled badly, and we decided to start preparing papers so that we were able to prepare papers and submit them within 8 days. It's because we started preparing them in December. It's not because we were this super machine that managed to do. We started preparing the papers in December because we suspected from the tone of the draft report that this is going to go in the wrong direction. I don't interact with advisors. I interact with the minister. The constitution says there must be regular consultation between the Reserve Bank and the cabinet member responsible for national financial matters. It is the Minister of Finance. So that's who I interact with. The others I would treat as comment. Suffice to say, we felt duty bound by the Constitution that when we felt that we are under attack, that we've got to stand up and defend this important institution of our democracy. It becomes so because granting institutions independence in terms of the Constitution is one thing. The most important is to put people in those institutions who will understand their mandate and execute it without fear, favor, or prejudice. And so at some stage people will even ask, if this mandate gets changed, would you resign? And says, why would I resign? Then I would have failed to act without fear or favor. I would have had to engage and protect the independence of the institution. And this is, as far as we are concerned, a step that we felt we could take to protect the independence of the institution. That for the benefit of this committee, the first certification judgment of the Constitutional Court had quite a section dedicated to the independence of the Reserve Bank, because there was contestation when the Constitution was certified as to whether the clauses that are in the Constitution are giving adequate protection to the independence of the Reserve Bank. And the Constitutional Court ruled that it actually does provide that, and that should there be changes, the Reserve Bank should approach the Constitutional Court to protect that independence. It's in that certification judgment. You don't have to read the whole judgment. The section that deals with the Reserve Bank is very short. It's like on one page. What's my position with regards to private shareholding? As I have said, many central banks, the older central banks, started being private. And as countries evolved, some of them decided to get rid of the private shareholders. It can be very costly. As the Spanish had to say to us, and the Bank for International Settlement, which used to have private shareholders, they said, it doesn't matter what, you're going to be slogging out in the courts, both domestic and international, for a very long time, and you are eventually going to come to the same conclusion that all of us had come to. You will have to pay them in order to get them to go away. So if that is what society wants, and would like to pay these shareholders for something they do not owe, well, that is a public policy choice that we can make. Of course, we've got to contrast that. Whatever the amount, ask ourselves, should we be using this amount to do something else that will benefit society, or would we rather be paying it to this private shareholder? For what benefit? To get rid of 200,000 rands per annum? Because that's all they are getting, 200,000 rands per annum. So as the Honorable Shivambo said, this is a vanity. If we think that as a society, we would like to just get rid of this vanity, for us from where we are sitting, we will not interfere with that process. We will only come in if those changes encroach on our independence. So if those changes encroach on our mandate and on our independence, you should expect a fight. So there are central banks which do not have private shareholders that are independent. Deutsche Bundesbank does not have private shareholders. It's feared to be one of the most independent central banks in the world. The Swiss National Bank has got private shareholders. It's seen as one of the most independent central banks in the world. And by the way, they are almost like the Swiss National Bank. The profits get distributed to the cantons. So it becomes the profitability of the Swiss National Bank becomes a very important public policy issue, because the cantons are funded from the profits of the Swiss National Bank. So what I'm saying is not that I feel strongly about the independence of the Reserve Bank. The issue of shareholders, from where we are sitting, whether it is one shareholder that is government, that could mean that our AGM will be probably very quick, because we'll just sit with one person and then we talk about the annual report and we are done, and then we will be out of there. What I'm saying is that at the moment there is a public meeting with this shareholder who can ask lots of questions. It adds to transparency. There are seven other people who are elected from outside that are not appointed by the executive, who ask us a lot of difficult questions when we are sitting in the board. But if you are an executive, you also don't like difficult questions, do you? So if they are no longer there and do not have difficult questions, it's okay. But is that good for transparency and public accountability? I would submit, no, it is not. So the undue influence, no, even prior to 2010, these people didn't have the undue influence. They tried to have that influence. And the eighth governor of the bank, Tito Mboweni, had his hands full with this shareholder, because they wanted to change the sub-act and said that they would want to be paid. So you don't have the power to change the sub-act. That power lies with the parliament, so forget it. So what did they do? They bought, yes, as you said, so one family bought for the spouse, for the children, for the grandparents, for the in-laws, and so on, until they amass all of these shares. But there was one little detail they had forgotten. They were foreigners, and if you are a foreign shareholder of the Reserve Bank, you are not allowed to vote. So after he had amassed all of these shares and discovered that can't vote them, he got really frustrated and got aggressive at the AGM. So if you ask someone, if the things are now with public, if it's all owned by the state, well, we will not have that aggressive shareholder. We might have one aggressive shareholder, which is just one. There's nothing that will stop one shareholder being aggressive with the bank. But if they interfere with the mandate of the bank, they will have a fight coming their direction. Any shareholders applying for banking licenses? No, we have not had. But what you would tend to have is that you would have a bank that has
been established, we should also look to have shareholding like all the others. Again, we do not think that it poses any conflict in as far as this is concerned. And you ask the question about Standard Bank, I was trying to find under which name it is, because many of them would have, the bank itself has evolved, but they confirm that yes, indeed, they are shareholders. Mutual that you have talked about, again, you had two different entities that owned this share, and after 2010, they are now associates, and because they are associates, they have to get rid of the of the balance. Financial surveillance and the investigations. Yes, you predicted correctly, Mr. Chair. But in our case, we've got to also put forth that we take many investigations and we take them to the point where they are handed over to the law enforcement authorities. And we, as Deputy Governor Naidu will walk you through this. He has many. Unfortunately, we can't say exactly which one, but we have got many that we have taken. To that level. And sometimes we do not want to say these things that indeed we are investigating. Besides that, it might undermine the ongoing investigation. We actually think sometimes some of the vitriol against the bank has to do with people who know what investigations we are busy with. And so Parliament must balance this, because we can sit here and say that we are indeed investigating so and so, and the vitriol against the bank then just becomes more pronounced than it has been. And yes, I mean, it's nice to walk down the street and people will say, "Well, congratulations, you guys are doing a good job." But there are people with nefarious intentions who, when we walk down the streets, will say, "Oh, we hear you are investigating us, and I'm not sure that we want to." So the idea of having a closed conversation with the committee might be something that would be useful. Honorable Shivambo, who owns the sub if the shareholders don't? Well, I suppose it's the one who takes 90% of the profit. Who takes 90% of the profit? It's the government. So that we talk about the economics of it. Government does not own the shareholding, but it takes 90% of the profit. That is because of this is a public interest institution, and that is how it was created. But like you said, we can get rid of this vanity stuff. If you get rid of this vanity stuff, well, 90% of the profits will still go there. Maybe it will be 90% plus 200,000, because that is what the other shareholders were getting, and then we will still have to keep 10% to build our capital and reserve. What other assets does the sub own? The biggest that we own is our foreign exchange reserve, by far the biggest. Gold and BOE. Those who trade gold, his department has traded gold. Gold was traded, and when you sell gold to somebody, they will tell you, "I want you to deliver my gold local New York or local London or local Zurich," which means that you bought 100,000, you have sold me 100,000 ounces. I want you to deliver it in New York. Now, it is a logistical nightmare every time somebody buys gold in London or there for us to be transporting it there. And since London is the world financial center and also the world center for the trading of commodities, it just made sense that it's not all the gold that is there, but the bulk of it ends up being there We still own it. It's in custody. It's not like this gold is lost to South Africans. It is ours. And if we decide that we are better off with it stored in the Reserve Bank in Pretoria, and we say, let it be moved here, we don't even have to move it. We can do what is called a location swap, which means that the gold that is produced here that was supposed to be sent to London, we will say to somebody, take our gold in London, we will keep the one here. It's as simple as that. I'm talking too much. The existence of other banks and so forth, and the concentration in the banking system. Every banking crisis leads to additional concentration in South Africa. What does ABSA stand for? It's Amalgamated Banks of South Africa. It was because there was a group of banks that ended up being put together to solve a banking problem, banking situation that you had in the aftermath of Bangkok. Nedbank itself includes the old board of executors, the old PAM bank, and so forth. Every banking crisis leads to a concentration. Why is it so? It's because the preferred resolution tool, when a bank fails, is to get another bank to buy it so that you do not use public resources. That leads to a concentration of the bank. And but as this was taking place in South Africa, we consciously took a decision that said, we will pursue a four-pillar model. We will not allow a situation where the four big banks end up merging and becoming fewer. It doesn't mean we do not allow others to come in, but it just means it's difficult for the others to come in, but the environment is there. But if anybody thinks that the banks that are going to come in will be able to take on the existing ones, ask the foreign banks. They couldn't succeed taking our banks. The market is very competitive. And the competition is going to come from alternative systems. And that has to do with technology. So Deputy Governor Naidu will tell you, of the two most recent licenses he had issued, are institutions that are using technology. They are using cell phones, they are using internet. They say, forget it, we are not going to be opening branches. It's just so expensive. And Naidu being Naidu, he says that, oh, but we need branches where our poor people are. They say to him, what do you mean? Your poor people use cell phones. Just give them the banking products on cell phones and they bank wherever they are. They don't need to be in a branch. Naidu, you are going to talk about these illicit flows, my friend. and then, of course, there was also the issue of state ownership of banks. Do you know that the state is the biggest financial conglomerate in this country? It owns the biggest asset manager on the African continent, with assets over a trillion. It owns the biggest pension fund in the form of the GEPF. It has got a bank that focuses on agriculture. It has got a bank that focuses on industrial development. It has got a retail bank, otherwise known as the post bank. It has got the National Housing Finance Corporation, which is supposed to be dealing with human resources. There are these institutions being concentrated. And to the chair's question, why doesn't the bank then get involved in development? And I would agree. So why don't we create an institution that will focus on development? And let's make sure it is not in Pretoria or in Johannesburg. Let us call it the Development Bank of Southern Africa and create its head office in Midrand. Truth of the matter is that such a bank already exists. So when we say that the central bank must then go and be in development, why did we create a Development Bank of Southern Africa? Are we suggesting that the Reserve Bank must take over the Development Bank of Southern Africa, take over the IDC, because you can't do development without industrial development. Fold it in here. You can't do development without agrarian reform and the financing of agriculture, so we must bring the Land Bank into the Reserve Bank. I think that our forebears were correct in separating the central bank from these things and created these specialized institutions to deal with these particular challenges that we are facing. Growth. We have a role in growth, not just a role. The Constitution says what we do must be in the interest of balanced and sustainable growth in the Republic. So we move from a premise that what we are doing has got to be in the interest of growth. If it was not in the interest of growth, then we shouldn't be doing this thing, because the Constitution says we are doing this in the interest of balanced and sustainable growth. But it is very clear that our primary object is the protection of the value of the currency. Naidu?
So before
we ask, I mean, we know from the public domain where things are. But maybe you could say something more. What's the stage at the moment with the post-bank licensing? You can deal with that, okay.
Thank you, Chair. Just give me a second.
Chair, on, let me start off. I'm going to deal with three issues: the illicit flows, the transformation in the banking sector, and the licensing issues in the banking sector, and then any other things that you'd like me to deal with. Chair, let me reassure you that my blood boils too when I read about these allegations of money being taken out. I think that's true for all of us. It abhors us that there's corruption in South Africa, that people use the financial system to take money out of the country.
Yes.
We do a huge amount to try and curb that, but we are often one step behind the tail. We are often not able to sufficiently curb illicit financial flows. In part because it's a complex issue, it requires the cooperation of various agencies and entities within South Africa, the police, the Hawks, the National Prosecuting Authority, the Revenue Authority, the Financial Intelligence Center, and in part because we need the cooperation of international jurisdictions. I'll give you an example. If state-owned enterprise X issues a contract to buy water from a company in a certain country, right? And they pay R1 billion to that company. That company then pays a kickback to an account in another country. It's from that country. It's entirely outside of our payment system. Right? We won't pick it up unless we hear about it through some email leaks, through which we can then follow up with our counterpart there. Right? So there's a huge amount that we are doing, but we would be the first to admit that the system is not perfect and it's not functioning as well as it should. Let me run through some of the successes that we have had. I sign about 2 or 3 forfeiture orders a month, probably to the tune of about 2 or 3 billion rand a year. Now, this is in the public domain because it's a government gazette. It's almost never reported in the media, but I'll read to you one that was. So on the 29th of May 2015, I ordered the freezing of all Hommikse bank accounts. On the 30th of December 2016, I ordered the forfeiture of all monies in the Hommikse bank accounts. There was only 14 million rand left at the time. Right? So we first froze the account, then we forfeited the money to the state. That's in a government gazette. On average, I think I sign 2 or 3 forfeiture orders a month. So there's a lot that we do. There's a lot that comes into the public domain. But it would also be fair to say that there's a lot that doesn't get to the public domain. At the moment, we have 41 cases that we have handed over to the police for prosecution or for further investigation. In terms of our powers and mandate, we can only take the process up to a certain point.
41 cases within what space? In the last financial year? Or?
No, this goes back 5-6 years.
41 over 5-6 years?
Yeah.
That's not many, but still.
We've handed 41 cases over. We've got one significant prosecution. So a lady by the name of Ms. Tian Tian Wang was prosecuted. She received an 11-year sentence. She was alleged to have taken out over 2 billion rand of money from South Africa.
How will you know my name?
She was not convicted for exchange control crimes. She was convicted because she attempted to bribe a Reserve Bank official to the value of 20 million rand. The Reserve Bank official came forward. We, together with the police, we put a wiretap on the individual employee, and after a sting operation, was able to arrest the woman for attempting to bribe a Reserve Bank official. So we got a prosecution and we got a big sentence. But we almost never get prosecutions for foreign exchange crimes or for exchange control violations. So that's part of the frustration.
Right? Sorry, why is that?
Can you explain?
I can't answer that, sir.
Right.
What do you mean you can't answer? Why don't you get prosecutions?
What we submit we lay the charges, right. We submit the information, and the prosecutors decline to prosecute.
Is it because they lack expertise or lack will?
I don't know whether it's
because they are bought over or what.
I don't know. But whether you lack of expertise,
I think that even when SARS was presenting, they gave the same illustration that there is no prosecution on key financial crimes that get to happen in South Africa. There's a lawless space.
Yeah, that's the issue for our discussion that we had postponed last time around because of the unavailability of members of the other committees. But that's on our agenda. I don't know what the date is to send out. All right, go ahead. We don't have time.
So, Chair, the point I'm making is that we take this job in the illicit flow is very seriously. We operate with other entities. We get some successes. We free significant amounts of money. We forfeit a significant amount of money. And we would be the first to admit that we're chasing the tail, and the tail often wins. We would welcome greater cooperation between the entities in South Africa on the matter. Chair, on the issue of concentration in the banking system, we fully accept that South Africa is a very concentrated banking system. We have to have two mandates in one sense. We have to try and promote competition in the banking sector while still protecting the stability of the financial sector. Last year we received three banking license applications, and those were the first time in 11 years that we had received banking license applications. And I stated in front of this committee, the three were one from the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, two from Discovery Bank, and three from the Post Bank. This year we have received two additional banking license applications, one for a mutual bank and one for a cooperative bank in the last few months. On what's happening on the Post Bank license. So in 2016, on the 3rd of June 2016, we issued what was called a Section 13 license to the Post Bank, which allows them to set up a bank, which allows them to register the company, register with the payment system, begin testing, appoint board members, appoint executives. They had until the 3rd of June 2017 to apply for a formal banking license. Chair, they have done that before the 3rd of June 2017. We are busy evaluating that application. There is, however, a legal issue that we have sought your cooperation in attempting to deal with in as speedy a manner as possible. The legal issue is as follows. The Banks Act says that you have to be a public company to have a banking license. The Companies Act says that if you are a state-owned company, you are explicitly not a public company. And the Post Bank Act says they are a state-owned company. So we will come to you, the Treasury will come to you, with a proposal to make a small amendment to the Banks Act to allow a state-owned company to have a banking license. We are fully supportive of that amendment. And as soon as we get that amendment through, we think it will significantly expedite the process of licensing the Post Bank or any other bank that the state wishes to license. Let me make it very clear that we will not lower the bar on the supervision of a state bank. We will not do that. From a capital point of view, from a systems point of view, from an integrity point of view, they will have to meet all the requirements that the banks access. We will not shirk in that responsibility because it would threaten the stability of the system. So, Chair, we think that we're taking steps to increase the diversity of the banking system, to reduce concentration, to increase competition, and I think the introduction of a state bank would aid in that process. The last point, Chair, on the transformation of the banking sector. We do agree that there has been progress, but we also agree that that progress has been insufficient. Chair, my appeal to you is to identify transformation as a multidimensional problem, not only about equity ownership. It's about whether banks lend to townships. It's about whether they lend to black people. It's about whether they lend to small businesses, whether they lend to women, whether they're able to support the township economy. It's about whether they're able to support industrial expansion, whether they can support infrastructure, housing development. Transformation must be seen as a multidimensional object. If you only push the issue of equity to the absence of the rest,
I'm not doing that.
And I'm not saying you do. I'm saying that there are some people who would only want to push the equity to the detriment of the rest. I think we'll have a less developed banking sector. And from the Reserve Bank point of view, we have some power and some influence, but the policymaker has got more power than influence. The Treasury has got more power. Thank you.
Can I suggest we move on? Because we're running out of time. We're 20 minutes over you. So can we ask that your next two inputs are 20 minutes each? Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Very quickly.
Could I just... Oh, yeah, okay. On the question of undue influence, what are the names of the approximately 15 shareholders who tried to engage in undue influence?
Yes,
you say that there is no person who is currently applying for a banking license who is also a private shareholder. That cannot be true. Mr. Adrian Gore of Discovery Holdings is a shareholder, and as I understand it, Discovery are also applying for a banking license. Now, the question there is that a conflict of interest, and possibly, even if it isn't, is it wise? Is it a wise practice? And the last question, just on the Financial Services Department's report in respect of VR Laser and Honex. I understand that there are constraints in the extent to which you can disclose information about that investigation, but can you at least confirm that that investigation has been completed and referred to the relevant authorities for further investigation, as the case may be?
Okay, Floyd, quickly, please.
Yeah, I have two questions as to what other assets do you own, and then you only mentioned the biggest asset that you own. The other assets that you own, and more specifically, like on the whole illicit flows, because when SARS came here, they said that they are working with the Sovereign Reserve Bank, and the Reserve Bank is dragging its feet. It doesn't seem to be clear of who is doing what. On the so everyone else is passing the button.
Yeah.
Whenever we then say, what is the comprehensive way of dealing with the money movement, no one seems to be clear of what.
We should stress that the Reserve Bank was here. We invite everybody. Now we're inviting the NPA, Willie Hoffmeyer was here, SARS, Reserve Bank, everybody. All of you were here. Okay, good.
Okay, Kubano will deal with later. I can assure you we do not drag feet. And I'm sure if I call the SARS president, say, why do you say these things about me in Parliament? He will say that you didn't hear me properly.
He wasn't the one who said it. A representative lower down.
So that's the thing. Mr. Mania, if anyone who is currently having shareholding applies for a banking license, it's a conflict, then those who are currently shareholders and have got banking license would also be in conflict. So that's where I'm coming from. Well, the individual you had mentioned again. Okay, let me leave it with Kuben, because he is the registrar of banks. He will understand where to stop. I might go forever.
Chair, we do not consider it a conflict of interest for the same reason that the governor has outlined earlier. The shareholders have got no influence or no role whatsoever in the operations of the Reserve Bank, either from a policy or from a supervisory perspective. I don't do a check on the share register on who owns the banks and shares of the South, because it bears no relevance either to the way in which we supervise a bank or the way in which we conduct our operations. On the Homex, I can confirm that that case has been concluded. There was a gazette published and the money was forfeited. On the VR Laser Asia, I cannot confirm that the investigation has concluded.
Okay.
Can you move on then? Sorry, do you...
Just maybe in response to Honourable Shivamba's question, I recall that when you first asked the question, it was maybe in relation to African Bank. If the issues are around whether we own any other banking assets, no, we don't, apart from a small shareholding that we have in the Bank for International Settlements, which is part and parcel of facilitating international central bank operation. But apart from that, the shareholding, which in itself, as you may be aware, is not a normal investment. It is an investment that we acquired as part of facilitating the resolution of the problem that had arisen at African Bank.
Okay,
over to you, Governor.
Thank you.
Chair, I still don't have my 15 names or commitment.
I wanted to come to that.
And I was trying to find what would be the easiest way of saying it. Let me put it to you this way. I give you the judgment because the people, all the offending shareholders were spelled out in that judgment in the High Court.
Thank you.
Thank you very much once again, Chair. That is the agenda. We have included additional slides which members can always refer to later. The presentation itself will be shorter. We're starting with the global economy, and we have picked that growth in the South African space has not followed world growth, and this is an anomaly. Because in 2008-09, when we got into a recession, we got into a recession because the global economy was slowing down. The global economy is now accelerating, and yet South Africa has now slipped into a recession. So the domestic response to this world growth is unusually weak, and this could be suggesting that the problems then are idiosyncratic. It's not that the reason why we face with this is because of a weak global economy. And when we looked internationally, it's only South Africa and Venezuela, which are sizable economies, which are currently in recession. Everyone else is actually growing. And the recession itself in South Africa is actually broad-based. Real GDP would have contracted for two consecutive quarters in the first quarter of 2019, even if we excluded the finance, insurance, real estate and business services sector. The only two sectors that showed growth was the agriculture sector and the mining sector. And I must say that we are worried because at the moment those two sectors are facing significant policy uncertainty, which could mean that we might actually go into an even deeper slowdown than we do unless certainty is actually restored in those sectors. Some good news is that we see gross fixed capital formation starting to turn positive. After it had four consecutive quarters of contraction, we are seeing fixed capital formation starting to grow. We still expect that in the second quarter of the year we will see some growth, but albeit a modest growth. But we also know that investment follows consumption. Household consumption expenditure contracted substantially at an annualized rate of 2.3% in the first quarter of 2017, and expenditure contracted by 12.1% in the clothing and footwear sector, restaurant and hotels by 8%, alcoholic beverages and tobacco by 7.4%, transport by 4.4%, and food and non-alcoholic beverages by 3.4%. So it was a broad-based slowdown in consumption expenditure. Well, employment can only come from growth. What does this mean for growth? What has been the recent employment outcome? As long as economic growth remains below 3%, if historical evidence is anything to go by, we run the risk of unemployment persistently rising. The number of unemployment persons increased notably by 433,000 from the fourth quarter of 2016 to the first quarter of 2017, and by 491,000 over the past four quarters. This increased the number of officially unemployed to around 6.2 million, raising the unemployment rate to 27.7% in the first quarter of 2017. The picture becomes more bleak when you look at youth unemployment. Youth unemployment rose from 50.9% in the fourth quarter of last year to 54.3% in the first quarter of this year. The essence of the picture that I am painting for you here is that formal non-agriculture private sector employment has not increased in absolute terms since the financial crisis, and most of the employment gains have come from the public sector. And the question here is, hasn't the public sector employment tapered off? And remember, these are absolute numbers based on Stats SA's quarterly employment survey. Formal non-agriculture employment, private sector employment, becomes important because the significance here is that the private sector accounts for 70% of the economy. So in recent years, the private tertiary sector created new employment opportunities at a moderate pace, whilst jobs were lost in the primary and secondary sector. This just tells you what we have seen in mining, manufacturing, and construction. It is the red line. You could see that it had been declining. So employment creation has actually, even when you looked back to 2013, had been primarily from the tertiary sector. And we have now seen that tertiary sector itself getting into recession, which means that the employment outlook becomes bleak. Let me turn now to interest rates and credit extension. Interest rates had often fluctuated lower since a peak in 1998. Interest rates are interrelated with the stance of business cycle in the economy, and the shaded bars show you when the business cycle was in decline. So during the downward phases in the cycle, interest rates have generally been lowered to support real economic activity in the economy, as the so-called output gap widens. The output gap is basically measured growth being below the potential growth of the economy. But maintaining positive real rates have been prudent for the containment of inflationary pressures in an economy, thanks to the credibility of monetary policy that we had had. Unlike in the past, the central bank didn't have to react to rising inflation in a manner that would choke off nascent economic recovery, and that actually gave the scope for the Reserve Bank to lower rates in the most recent monetary policy committee. Well, interest rates impact on loans and advances, and the slide here shows that growth in long-term loans, in total loans and advances to the domestic private sector improved marginally from March 2017 to May, after it had moderated during the course of 2016. Well, for monetary policy, that is history, and there is nothing we can do to affect history. The focus has got to be what our take about what's going to be happening in the future, because that is what affects our policy stance. Headline inflation slowed from a peak of 6.8% in December to 5.1% in June this year. The moderation in consumer price inflation in recent months was fairly broad-based among the various goods and services subcategories. Consumer goods price inflation decelerated from 5.5% in May 2017 to 4.7% in June this year. Moderating fuel and electricity price inflation in July 2017 could reduce headline CPI by around 0.6 percentage points, making it highly probable that inflation could approximate the midpoint of the inflation targeting range in that month. Petrol price inflation will slow notably up to July 2017 and is expected to subtract 0.7 percentage points from July headline inflation rate compared with the rate in May. So in spite of the most recent announcement in the increase in the petrol price, the petrol price is still lower than what it was earlier in the year. Electricity prices have become an important factor, and so far we have based on our assumption on what has been granted by NERSA. We're not sure what ESCOM is going to be asking. There are talk of them asking something again around the 18-20%. If that is the case, it will change the inflation outlook significantly. The slowdown in consumer food price inflation since December 2016 has been fairly widespread among the various food price subcomponents,
And this does not require much explanation. It had to do with the fact that we had good rain and that we then had a very good crop, and so that had had an impact on consumer food prices. But despite the uptick in formal non-agricultural unit labor cost growth in the first quarter of 2017, both measures of nominal unit labor cost have trended lower over the past year. This becomes very important. I see the screen has gone blank, this one, but I guess people can still look at the... It becomes very important because it feeds into the producer price inflation and subsequently into headline inflation. Something that had been a plus, the appreciation of the exchange value of the rand since the early 2016 has contributed significantly to the recent moderation in CPI inflation, particularly for underlying goods. But the rand remains vulnerable to domestic development and has proven to be reacting quite a volatile manner to domestic political and policy development. Well, what are our expectations for the second quarter of 2017? Is there a disconnect between the real economic indicators and confidence? As the former Treasury Secretary of the U.S., Larry Summer, would tell us, that the cheapest form of economic stimulus that you could have is to restore business and consumer confidence. You do not have to pay anything. You just have to put in place an environment that restores that, and economic activity begins once again. We are seeing both business and consumer confidence being at historic lows. And actually, business confidence now is less than what it was in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. So, and that has got implications for what it means for investment in the economy. Confidence also fell in all the five sectors surveyed by the PBR in the second quarter of 2017. The more worrying thing is the low confidence in the manufacturing and building contractor confidence, because if we are saying that at the heart of our development is going to be industrialization and the manufacturers are not having confidence, that tells you that we have a significant problem. Business confidence has also been impacted by a number of constraints, and in the main, it has to do with the domestic policy environment. Although they had also mentioned the issue of insufficient demand, the grey line is what business people say with respect to the general political climate. They say that is a serious constraint to their investment activities. Well, we are a small open economy that is integrated with the global economy, and the external sector becomes important. Here we are basically heading with the real gross domestic product and the balance on the current account of the balance of payments. The deficit on the current account of the balance of payments expressed as a percentage of GDP narrowed from 4.4% in 2015 to 3.3% in 2016. Basically, the current account deficit tells us that we are consuming much more than what we are producing as a country, and that difference has got to be coming from elsewhere. Put differently, we are investing more than our savings capacity, and as such, we have got to attract foreign savings. So the notion then that says that when you have got to finance this current account deficit, when you need foreign savings to finance it, that you could actually say, I do not care about the foreign savings, shows that people are failing to understand this connect, that as a small open economy, you are actually faced with. And here when I talked about the savings here, it's not what is in the bank, but sometimes I hear South Africans say, oh, there's so many assets in the insurance companies, surely that is the savings of the nation. Says, no, savings here is a flow concept. Savings is the difference between the income you earned this year and what you had spent against that income, not what is in the bank account. That is in the past and it becomes a stock rather than savings for the for the year. So this is the financial account. That is what we have to attract in order to finance that current account deficit. And you can see that in the main, we finance our current account deficit through net portfolio investment. And those net portfolio investments, depending on whether they are equity or they are bonds, if they are bonds, they become what we call ratings sensitive, which means that they look at what your rating is, and if our rating deteriorates, you will actually could see a situation where those portfolio flows reverse. And if they reverse, that means you can't finance the current account deficit, which means that that gap of resources that you have between savings and investment cannot be filled. And in that case, given that you don't have an option of increasing your own savings, the only thing left is that you are going to have to constrain investment. And if that happens, you are going to have an adverse impact on growth and, by extension, an impact on employment in an environment where we are facing rising unemployment. So understanding that dynamic becomes crucial. This is the forecast. I call this the Sangoma slide because we're not quite sure. We have got our growth forecast, and then we said that well, it can be up in this direction or it can be low in this direction. So our focus is the red line, but we are saying to you there could be other things. If we have done the right thing, that growth could be here. If we do the wrong thing, it might actually be less than what we had actually forecast. Inflation, I had talked about this thing earlier. This is just the picture in, this is just the inflation story in picture form. If we wanted to know what the kind of monetary policy stance we have taken, it got reflected by the fact that on a forward-looking basis, we expect inflation to continue to be within our inflation target. Again, we have put this thing and said that it's varied depending on what happens with the factors that we have identified as risks to the inflation. If they materialize, like the depreciation of the currency, inflation could end up higher. But if the picture is better, it will end up being lower. So in summary, the contraction in the real GDP in the first quarter of 2017 was broad-based. Confidence and sentiment indicators weakened further in the second quarter of 2017, possibly exaggerated somewhat by the political environment. Households surveyed employment increased in the year to the first quarter of 2017, but unemployment rate rose further. And the near-term outlook for CPI inflation had improved further, and hence enabling the Reserve Bank to retain an accommodative monetary policy stance. I'm sure I was within the 20 minutes.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Right, over to members. Yes, Mr. Mania. Anybody else want to speak? Floyd? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. Governor, I wonder if you could explain what the consequences of what you call the political environment are for growth and employment. That's the first question. The second question is, what do you believe, given your interactions with the ratings agencies, what do you believe the effect of the assault on the Reserve Bank will be on the sovereign credit rating of South Africa? Then in terms of investment, as I understand it, private sector investment ticks up in 207 Q1 for the first time, I think, in four quarters. Why was that the case? The fourth question is, you mentioned in the slide which you referred to as the Sangoma slide, that there are either government can do the right things or the wrong things. What are the right things which you believe government need to implement in order to ensure higher rates of growth and employment in South Africa?
The slide which you said is a Sangoma slide, Governor. What is your focus? What are the focus, the exact numbers? And you say that if certain things are done right
He said, what is likely to be...
On growth or on inflation?
Yeah, on growth.
That's the figures in green. At the
so your prediction is that if things are done correctly, it will be 1.5%.
If things stay where they are now.
It will be 1.5%. Yes. And then if things are done wrongly, what will be the number?
Well, we have not calculated it because we don't know what wrong things will be done.
And what could be the wrong things? That is my interest.
Yeah.
So because you know you are a governor who must protect the financial stability and everything. So you must speak openly. You must not tiptoe around politicians. Like you must speak much more clearly in terms of these are some of the things that that is why we're speaking about protecting the autonomy and independence of the bank so that you are able to guide without fear or favor to say that if this continues in this particular fashion, this is the likely consequences in terms of, because once we get into an annual recession, it's going to be a crisis level because everyone else is going to panic. And it might sustain for a longer period of time. And when we take over government in 2019, it will be difficult to repair the damages that would have been done by those that are doing that now.
Can you comment in particular on what the bank's projections are about the EFF's prospects? let's start with 2039 onwards.
I'd be very happy to comment on the ANC's prospects. Some reliable data.
Okay. Mr. Mania, the political uncertainty we had mentioned in at least three MPC meetings. And I must say to you that I go to the BIS meetings every second month. And in the past two meetings that I had attended, my colleagues keep on asking me, what is going on in your country? And central bankers are not the ones to worry about other people's economies. If they do, that could suggest that their own private sectors are worried about what is happening in South Africa. And these are not central bankers of small countries. These are central bankers of our major trading partners. And so very clearly, this has had an impact. Of course, it didn't help that in January when I had to go for the BIS meeting, it was after the public protector had released the first report. And it didn't help that in May when I went to the BIS, it was so well timed that the public protector's report was released on the Monday and I was leaving that Saturday to go to the BIS. And I had colleagues asking me, oh, you always come here and tell us you are one of the most independent central banks in the emerging world, to which the governor of the Bank of England said, do you know that the Bank of England, although it's way older than South Africa, became independent after the South African Reserve Bank. South African Reserve Bank became independent with the interim constitution, and the Bank of England only became independent in 1997, and says that, so we had this thing, we thought you are a beacon, but it looks like this thing is about to be taken away. Central bankers are not the ones to cry wolf unless they are worried. And so I took it that this is a very clear signal that the uncertainty is impacting on the confidence of investors. Now it is no longer just domestic, but foreign as well. And that emboldened us even more to contest the findings of the public protector, because it was very clear that if they carry, they would have far-reaching consequences for this economy. And by the way, Mr. Minya, you talked about the minister. One of the most powerful supporting candidates to protect the independence of the Reserve Bank came from the Speaker of the House. If members have not read it, you must read that affidavit. It was a very powerful affidavit. Which then brings me to what you had called the assault on the sub. Just yesterday, Moody's released a report. And they said that in assessing the credit standing of South Africa, one of the things we see as a strength is the standing of the Reserve Bank and its independence. And if that begins to be undermined, we may have to reconsider whether this is still a strength or not. And that is quite telling, because there is something about us which I do not understand. The institutions that are working and are working well seem to be the ones under attack. And that creates a significant problem. But I've got 2,000 people working for the Reserve Bank. Think of them. Think when they wake up every day and go to work. And they have to grapple with this thing without knowing what they think will happen to this institution. It becomes a problem. And I think that the sooner this uncertainty is cleared, the better it would be for the socio-economic of the well-being of all South Africans, to borrow from the Public Protector's report. What led to investment ticking up in, it was not one quarter, it was two consecutive quarters. It was the first quarter and the last quarter of last year. Part of it has to do with base effect. Because you had had such a big contraction in the previous years, in the previous quarters, the quarters that come, that's why that growth is not that big. It's really marginal. But you have also heard that the two big SOEs continued to expand their investment. Still, this kind of growth is not what we are looking for. Remember that we once said that we would like to raise investment to GDP to about 25%. We are currently at about 18. So what are the things that will get us to the higher rate? You know, I mean, you and Honorable Shivam, we are sitting in two extremes. He's that side, and you are this side.
He's on the right.
And then he says, yes. And so he says, what are the wrong things that could be done? And he says, what are the right things that could be done? I am not sure about what are the wrong things that could be done, but I can tell you what I think could go wrong. But why don't I start from what are the right things that must be done? Firstly, we must get rid of the policy uncertainty. If you are to sink a mining shaft for 30 years and the mining policy of a country changes every time there is a change of government or of minister, why would you want to do it? Because there is uncertainty. Certainty for you. These are long term. Ditto if you are a farmer who must worry about long term trajectory and you're not sure that you would have these things. I'm giving this because these are seems to be you are in for the long run. But you can say the same about factory owners and all of these things, and unless we restore that confidence, we are going to have a problem. So our problems are structural. And these structural things run beyond, because I'm in the house, they run beyond the political cycle.
The decisions have got to be taken, and those decisions, when they are taken, have got to look beyond the term of any particular government. And these structural issues have to do with what we do in the education sector. What are we doing in the national logistics facilities? What are we doing? The economies are now becoming smarter economies and economies of the future. And economies of the future, they all are looking at technology, they are looking at data and the cost of data and broadband and all of that. These things are not rocket science. And by the way, many of these things are in the National Development Plan. And they just have to go and be done with concrete plans and say this is what could be done. So I guess that makes it easier for me to answer what could go wrong. What could go wrong would be a failure to implement them.
Just before you get to the what could go wrong, on the, what are the right things that need to be done to say we need policy certainty,
yeah,
or get rid of the policy uncertainty, but you ended there. But there's certainty that money is being stolen, that there's corruption, and that there's wrongdoing. So surely, I mean, that's got nothing to do with policy uncertainty. It's got to do with a reality that is impacting negatively. So you fail to say we must deal decisively and credibly with corruption and stealing, and we must be seen to be doing it. That didn't really come out as one of the things we have to do.
Okay. Well, I thought I was going to say that is what could go wrong, is that the thieving could continue. But you are right. Because those things impact on business confidence. Because just think of the multinationals that were caught doing wrong things in this economy of late. The others who are thinking elsewhere look at this and say, is that how you do business in that country? And the ethical ones could say, I am not in there. And or alternatively, you are going to attract investors with nefarious objectives because they think the country is for the take, and that could then come and do these things, and that becomes problematic. And but these things that you have raised, Honourable Honeycomb, also talk to the other things. The chair said he is boiling about these things that are happening. The truth of the matter is that if nothing is done, people will ask, is there still a rule of law in South Africa? Because if these things are done and everybody says, I have done the thing, I have handed over this, why doesn't the full might of the law take its course, will be the question. And that will have an impact on all of this thing. And of course, as I said, that what could go wrong will be those things taking place. But more importantly, if we fail to act, if we fail to act to restore confidence, we are going to get into all sorts of trouble. Last year, economic growth was below population growth. That means South Africans are getting poorer. There are more South Africans entering the job market than the economy is creating jobs. And this economy can't create jobs unless it is growing. We know from evidence that the South African economy, when it is growing at around 3% or higher, once it starts growing at that rate, you end up creating jobs for every percentage of growth. That is in the past. For every percentage of growth that you end up growing jobs by up to 0.6%. Okay? These are our old coefficients. We don't know what it would look like going forward. So, like I said, it is possible that you could have jobless growth, that the economy is growing but jobs are not created, but you can never have a jobful contraction. You could never have the economy that is contracting and it creates jobs. Just, it can't happen. So for us to create the jobs, we need to grow this economy. Gentlemen, I'm sure I've missed something.
Shall we move on then to the annual report? Thank you, Governor.
Do you always realize
a constant theme that that comes in this annual report, that we are saying that we serve the economic well-being of South Africans. And so the strategic focus areas that we then ended up adopting were all meant to be driving us promoting the economic well-being of all South Africans. We have adopted these strategic focus areas in 2015. So the year that we are reporting on, 2016-17, is the first year where we start to report against this strategic focus area. And the strategic focus areas flow from our mandate in terms of the constitution. And the first one being maintaining headline inflation within the target range. The target range being 3-6, the average for that fiscal year 2016-2017 is 6.3, marginally outside of our target, and we say that the target was missed, but going forward, as we had seen already in the first quarter of this financial year, we expect that we would be within the target, and we expect that we will be within the target over the next 8 quarters. And so we assess ourselves, we are outside of the target, but not by much. And I then come over to strategic focus area two, which is financial stability. I've asked the deputy governors to each talk to their relevant focus areas. Francois Group is responsible for strategic focus area two, which is to protect and enhance financial stability to achieve a safer financial system.
Thank you, Governor, and thank you, Honourable Chair. So strategic area, focus area two deals with financial stability objective as set out there on the slide, which is to protect and enhance financial stability to achieve a safer and stable financial system. So the key performance measures that we have defined there refers to policy action based on a set of macroprudential indicators in order to mitigate some of the vulnerabilities. What we have done there, Chair, is to publish a macroprudential policy paper. Obviously, we're engaging a public consultation process, and that would be refined. And I think it's very important also to bear in mind that although these are specific objectives set for this particular past year, that typically our planning horizon stretches over 3-4 years. As you can imagine, the process of policy making is sometimes a fairly extensive process, particularly if you want to achieve a high level of public participation. And in terms of what we have achieved there is the publication of that particular paper. Secondly is to develop a framework for measuring systemic risk. Part of what one wants to do is you want to develop a composite indicator that gives you an indication as to what is happening within the economy and whether systemic risks are busy escalating or declining within the economy. These are fairly complex econometric models that we build, and obviously these are just one of the inputs that we look at in assessing the degree of systemic risk that is building up within the economy. And we have not achieved that objective. Needless to say, that doesn't mean that a heck of a lot of work hadn't been done during the past year. But as you can imagine, before we release something to the public, this goes through several rounds and iterations within the bank so that when we do put out policy position papers, that it is of the quality and standard that you would have come to expect from the Reserve Bank. The third issue is looking at measures to implement the effective supervision, regulation, and oversight of financial market infrastructures. Chair, this is in anticipation of the Financial Sector Regulation Bill, where in terms of that bill, the bank will assume responsibility for financial market infrastructure supervision. Currently, in terms of FMI, we look after the payment system, but that will obviously include other FMI market infrastructures, and we Certainly internally done a lot of work in terms of how we will be supervising that, as that is a new function within the bank. And then lastly, the mechanism for the implementation for the coordination of crisis management. There we say it's planned, we've worked with the World Bank in designing a crisis simulation exercise that will be done in October of this year. This will, however, not be the first time we've done an exercise. We've done one around mid-2014, and one of the structures we have is the Financial Sector Contingency Forum, where we work across regulators and with key players and stakeholders of industry to plan for sort of a Armageddon scenario. And as far as that is concerned, we have... I've referred to the work that we're doing with the World Bank, and also very, very importantly, we've completed a draft special resolution bill that we're working on, and very important, which is different, is included in there is a deposit insurance scheme that currently is included in those proposals and which is currently engaged in the process of public consultation. That is something new for South Africa. One of the big things we are still exercising our mind is the funding of that, and we're still refining our work as far as the funding mechanism is concerned. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. If Deputy Governor Groop's area does what we would call macro-prudential supervision, then my area broadly covers micro-prudential supervision, that is the supervision of individual institutions. Banks, but also authorized dealers and authorized dealers with limited authority. Our strategic objective is to promote and enhance the safety, soundness, and integrity of these institutions. We largely break them up into two groups, what we call systemically significant institutions, and those that are smaller, less systemically significant. And we have slightly different regulatory standards for the significantly important financial institutions relative to those that are not significantly important institutions. Our target measure is that 100% of them meet or exceed the quantitative prudential standards in terms of capital adequacy, liquidity coverage ratio, maturity mismatch, etc. For the SIFIs, for the non-SIFIs, the target is 100% or if somebody does not meet that, they are under intensive supervision, and we often put financial institutions under intensive supervision. The third area of performance is around governance and risk management practices. We do that through a fairly detailed framework that investigates the bank's governance models, whether they have boards, the composition of those boards. We do fitness and propriety testing on people who are nominated to serve on boards. We have to approve the chair of the audit committee, the chair of the risk committee, and the C-suite positions in banks. So we have to give what we call BA020 approval for that, fitness and propriety test, and we do that. Chair, the area that where we have not met our performance for the 2016-17 financial year is largely around a review of the financial market infrastructure, the principles for financial market infrastructures, and that's largely because we don't yet have the powers to supervise FMIs. It'll come under the FSR bill when that is introduced. Chair, that's briefly it. The main objective going forward is to implement the Prudential Authority, take over insurance supervision, introduce conglomerate supervision, and ensure that the processes in place in terms of the FSR bill are given effect. We hope that we can launch the PA fairly soon, in the next 3 or 4 or 5 months, as soon as the bill is signed by the President. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. One other key strategic focus area that we focus on at the bank is to make sure that we enhance South Africa's resilience to external shocks. And we look in that regard to measurements such as the an adequate level of our foreign exchange reserves, and also having mechanisms and frameworks in place that will help us address external shocks that may arise to the financial markets or the financial system as a whole. And with regard to the system, we then work closely with Deputy Governor Groop and his area in terms of overall financial stability. We have made some good progress, and maybe I should just step back and highlight for the benefit of the committee why it is so exceedingly important that we have an adequate level of foreign exchange reserves. Firstly, it is important that we support and maintain confidence in our monetary policy and foreign exchange policies, that we limit external vulnerability by maintaining adequate foreign exchange liquidity to absorb shocks in times of crisis. Many of you may recall that going into the Asian financial crisis in the 90s, one of the key vulnerabilities that was detected at the time was a low level of reserves that made the crisis rather much worse than it would otherwise have been, and since then we've seen them accumulating reserves. The other issue has to do, of course, with giving confidence to the financial markets that South Africa at all times will be able to meet its current and future foreign exchange obligations, and lastly, also to ensure that in playing the role of being a banker to government and providing international treasury services to government departments, that we can assist them in meeting their FX obligations at all times. So during the reporting period, we made good progress with regard to accumulation of reserves, benefiting to an extent from large M&A-related transactions that took place towards the in the third quarter of last year. If you look at the actual annual report, the figures may be a little bit confusing in the sense that it shows our gold and foreign exchange reserves having declined somewhat to 618 billion rand when compared to 688 in the previous year. This has to do with exchange rate movements and revaluations, because those reserves are held in different foreign currencies. And during the reporting period, we've seen an appreciation of the exchange rate of the rand overall, which obviously reduced the value of our foreign assets. The rand improved from 1473 as at the end of the previous financial year to about 1327. And now, and similarly, as far as our gold reserves are concerned, the gold price also declined from just over 18,000 rands to about 16,500 rands. With regard to the second area of seeking to build a framework and mechanisms to deal with external shocks, we've got some way to cover there. But we have made progress with regard to establishing a crisis reaction manual for financial markets, which is in the process of being finalized and which will be incorporated into the overall SARB's crisis management and resolution framework. So this will allow us to have a more comprehensive and integrated framework to be better prepared for when crisis strikes. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. First of all, I've got probably the greatest job of the four governors in the bank, if not in the world, because I can rightfully claim that I print money for a living. And it's not a bad form of money printing monetization, it's the actual physical printing of physical currency. I also tell my colleagues always, this is probably the first pillar of financial stability, because if you don't have physical currency available, you have long queues outside of ATMs and banks, and people start running amok if they can't access. So the supply of physical currency is a very, very important aspect of the work that we do, and as of the end of last year, roughly about 130 billion rand of physical banknotes and coin were in circulation in the South African economy. The work that we do here is to ensure that we optimize the supply chain, that we ensure that we maintain critical buffer levels, which ranges between about 6 to 12 months of physical money supply. Just after the crisis, a number of economies that experienced a global financial crisis had a surge in withdrawal of physical cash, which equaled about 9 times the average monthly issuance of physical currency. So it's very critical that we maintain significant amounts of physical cash so that we can deal with any surges should there be uncertainty, because in times of economic uncertainty, people revert to physical assets. And in this particular case, they would typically revert to physical banknotes. And so we look, therefore, at optimizing supply chain. We've done a lot of work around that in terms of optimizing the footprint of our branch networks, also looking at quality measures to ensure that we produce quality banknotes. And, of course, very, very critical is the work we do around counterfeiting, because if counterfeiting levels within the economy is very, very high, people lose confidence in the physical banknotes. And as you can see, we have counterfeit levels that are very, very comfortable within the acceptable international norms, which is roughly in the vicinity of 80 to 100 ppm, which is parts per million. In other words, for every a million notes in circulation, we have roughly about 10 counterfeits, and typically our controls are in such in place that these things are picked up very, very early. So this is very, very critical work that is done. It's not just in this area, and then of course the notes that we issue to ensure that these notes are fit. Some of the work that's not here that's in the annual report is we've continued with the efforts to turn around the subsidies, and both subsidies have made significant profits compared to the losses that we made about 5 years ago in the subsidies. And just on a side note, one of the objectives that we have as a country is beneficiation, and one of the things that the South African Reserve Bank does is beneficiation. We sold last year about 1.255 million ounces of Krugerrands, which is a form of beneficiation of the gold that is produced in the South African economy, and that accounts for probably about 16 to 70% of all gold production. Thank you, Chair.
Presentation.
Thank you very much. Questions, please? Floyd? Mr. Lees? Anybody else? No. Okay.
Well, thanks, Chair. I think maybe more than questions, like, must then speak to what we think should be the strategic focus of the Reserve Bank. Say that when they come and speak in the next reporting period, they then speak to some of the issues that we legitimately as public representatives should raise with the bank. And I think part of those should be the whole diversification of the owners of the banking spaces, like that. There can't be few banks that are existing. We must allow a broader space for other bank owners, which of course must be inclusive of the state bank, which will be the post bank in this instance, and South African black owners of banks, like that there should be a deliberate effort to enable such to happen. I think that is what we should be given a report on. I did not hear you, Kuben, when you were speaking about what is the issue on the Commonwealth Bank of Australia and the Discovery Bank in terms of but that is one thing. That the first issue is that diversification must be achieved in terms of what should happen. But also, I don't know, like, if there can be a way of dealing with the cartel practices of the existing banks. I don't know if the Financial Services Regulatory Bill, which will be an act before you come to the report next, will give you the mandate to broadly deal with the cartel practices. I honestly believe that banks are engaged in monopolistic behavior, particularly with regards to mortgage and vehicle financing. That, and now you're going to oversee insurance companies, the same thing. They are engaged in such practices. Like, there's really no difference in terms of pricing of the insurance companies. They even jointly advertise insurance products because they know that there isn't a huge difference between what they offer, and there's no real competition that is expected to happen as per the law. The same issue of why 30 years for a house of 500,000 and 5 years for a car of 500,000, those things should be looked into so that we there are issues that have to be responded to. But the most important thing is, Chair, I think that there should be a task force on illicit financial flows that is constituted of the Reserve Bank, of SARS, of the Financial Intelligence Center, the Hawks, and the National Prosecutions Authority. Perhaps we can consolidate that as part of the report of the process that we're engaged in with the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. But there should be something done. Perhaps we could mandate of these institutions, the one that has got a degree of credibility now and integrity is the Reserve Bank. Perhaps the Reserve Bank could be the one that convenes that platform to deal decidedly with the illicit financial flows and make follow-up on how do we detect it, and that there must be prosecution by those that are supposed to prosecute. There must be thorough investigations by those that are supposed to investigate and make sure that certain cases are settled. Because as things stand, it's not a crime to commit financial crimes in South Africa. That is what it is, like to be engaged in massive financial illicit flows. It's not a prosecutable offense. No one will prosecute you for, even when there is references that you've moved money illegally, no one acts on it. So there must be a consolidated and integrated effort to deal with it, and maybe a task force to deal with illicit financial flows should be convened and be and specifically convened by the relatively autonomous Reserve Bank. Because if it's convened by the Hawks or by NPA, you know the challenges of NPA. I think Shona Brown has taken permanent leave and he's nowhere to be found. He's not acting on any crime against anyone. So we might need a different approach to deal with it in a much more durable and sustainable way. Those are some of the key issues which I think we need to be guided on. We need a bank ownership that reflects the demographics of South Africa. Thank you.
Mr. Lees.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks to the Governor and his colleagues. The annual report, the financial section, is always a happy picture to look at for the Reserve Bank, and as it should be, the day we have a qualified audit there, I think, is the day we need to run that hill. But well done to everyone. The only question I really have is the guarantee given to Able. It hasn't been called up at all in the current and the last financial year. What are the prospects of that being called up? When does it actually cease to exist?
Any other comments, questions from members? No. Can I just raise one or two practical things before you answer? I think some of the issues, Floyd, you are raising, but let's leave the Governor to respond. Actually, policy issues that Parliament should really decide on. Some of the proposals you've got, just to alert the Governor, we've already taken decisions on. We have proposed to the Minister to lead an interministerial committee on illicit financial flows. That's in our report on the budget. It is something that we raised at the last meeting, and it's something that we now should take further action on. So I think one proposal that's emerging from what you're saying, Floyd, is that we write to the Minister. I'll do it in the next 48 hours. Saying we want to know what progress there has been in regard to this interministerial committee. We also have proposed that all those organizations come together in a structure. So we've agreed on that, but the truth is we haven't followed up on that. So that too is something I'll mention in my letter to him and CC it to the minister's concern. That means the Minister of Police and so on, whom I've spoken to twice, and who at least on the surface is very clear. Something has to be done. It's unacceptable, he said to me. You know, that there are 5,000 cases, I'm told. I said to him, I don't know if it's accurate and nothing's happening and so on. In fact, he hinted to me the second time when I spoke to him that he'll come himself if necessary. So the 29th of August, colleagues, is the date tentatively set. There's one slight glitch. One of the committees that's agreed is now retreating. And I think that because of the situation, we should just go ahead, really. Three of the four committees are available. I will try that the chair again. I won't mention the number of SMSs, calls, emails, and so on. that I have to do just to get two committees together. Getting four, you can imagine. But I would like to suggest we just go ahead, because still the full committees are available for the 29th of August. Then can I remind members once again, let's have this as a final deadline, to facilitate an effective exchange, a productive exchange with the police. Can people, I know the DA has done this already, Mr. Menya, you've sent us some questions. Can you look at them again? You seem to have a very good researcher who captures everything. You write the questions, yes, but obviously somebody who reads every little newspaper, no politician can do that. All right, fine, whoever it is from the DA that does that research, can that person finally update the questions? So by Friday at noon, the ANC is still battling 2.5 years later to get a researcher. But nothing stops parliamentary researchers. Antonia and Zakele, on behalf of the committee as a whole, can you look at questions? So we add them. On the issue of, I'm saying all these things because some of the things are not really your concerns, but you might want to comment on them. The new issue that Floyd is bringing up is that the SARB should coordinate these structures. Maybe you want to comment on that. It's a policy issue maybe, I don't know. If you're saying, Floyd, that it is the most credible of the institutions, personally I agree. I don't know what the majority in this committee feel, and I would personally actually come to think of it. It's my personal view. It's not a mandated view. The ANC study group will meet next week, Tuesday, and we'll take a position on that. But for now, I think the ANC should seriously consider it, that if it's possible, I don't know if it's allowed. But obviously, you know what the cabinet would usually say, as Derek will remind us, it's they who decide. Obviously, it's even the Minister of Finance that must coordinate, and it is he will decide which institution. But there's nothing stopping us from recommending that it must be the Reserve Bank. Can the ANC apply its mind to that? I think it's a reasonable proposal. Then I want to also say that on the transformation of the financial sector, we're not going to relent. And Kuben, to say we agree with you that looking at, can you send us a paragraph for our report? Just see what it looks like of what you said. You put it very nicely, that when you consider transformation, you have to consider not just equity and ownership, but all these other things. You can have an African-owned bank that doesn't actually serve the needs of the vast majority, right? That's true. But we are saying, and we also have, because we've engaged with so many institutions that also share your values, as well as many others that don't, we've got both sides pretty well covered, actually. So we a bit less, let's say, romantic and populist than maybe some of us in the majority party were before the hearing started. You might also be interested to know, if you don't know already, that AFF has made a proposal, which the ANC is seriously considering, and we'll take a decision on, which we'll have to do before, let me remind members, the draft report is meant to be considered on, the draft report is meant to be before us on the 22nd, right? So we need it the week before, right? And then we will finalize the report after we consider the JSE and transformation, because that's a big issue. So the finalization of the report will be on the 12th of September. So we'll alert you to this, that what Floyd is saying is correct. We're not going to be reckless. We're not going to be populist. But on the other hand, we can't fold our arms. It's in all our interests, not least the governor of the Reserve Bank and the SARB, that we do effect transformation, bearing in mind all the sensitivities of the low growth rate and so on. Then I also think we welcome the speaker's vigorous defense of the institution of the Reserve Bank and its independence. I also think, though, Governor, I don't have your technical skills and your knowledge. I heard your response to what I'm saying. I will do more reading before I come back to you on the earlier questions about, well, yes, must protect the currency, ensure financial stability, especially now with the new bill, ensure that overall, we contribute via the Reserve Bank to growth and jobs. And I also was interested in your answer, which I hadn't thought about personally, maybe others here have, that actually there are all these other banks. And what you're saying is, well, what are you really saying? You must absorb the IDC, absorb the land bank, and so on. I hadn't thought about that, but the people who argue you can do more are far more sophisticated than me. I'm sure they've thought about that. So I will come back to you on that. I feel I'm not able to take you on. I'm not entirely convinced by your answer. And I don't want to take you on now because I just don't have the capacity. But a year from now, or sooner, having done the reading, and Rachele and Antonio will do a little work, I would like to come back. I don't think, Governor, I don't think, committee, that we should not have a debate about this. It's important because, also in your own interest. Interestingly, I've got a rude SMS, as people are to me. Sometimes Derek is rather rude, but he doesn't know how rude people are to me. So actually, I'm much softer than others are to me. There is a chairperson of a provincial, my buddy, actually. He says, why are we not here? He's a chairperson of the finance committee in that province. Actually, he's right to vote. I think, although there is the NCOP, I think some of these sittings should be a joint NCOP, which often happens, NCOP-NA sitting. This is, I don't think this through. And secondly, I think in some occasions, can members please remind us that when there are certain sittings, we should invite the chairpersons and whoever else wants to come from the provinces. And where there's space, they must participate. So in short, can we do that? I think this comrade is quite right. Presumably he's covered on Channel 408. So he's obviously aware of what's happening right now. He said it's very interesting. I think he was referring more to my questions, Governor, than your responses. I'm teasing you, of course. He actually was very complimentary about it. It matters. It's worrying because he's an SACP Central Committee member, and he's saying these things about the Reserve Bank, and something the SACP needs to apply its mind to. So anyway, I think we will do that in future. We will, Thibault and Alan and whoever, must remind us that we must invite people. But on the transformation of the financial sector, we also think it's in your own interest to get more actively engaged. And I think this debate about the role of the bank, somebody put the question to me, shouldn't we discuss it? And I said, no, let the courts, let's not get embroiled in that. And I want to say once again, those of us who are asking for the debate are not all from the same category. In fact, we are diametrically opposed to each other. And I think there should be more of a debate on this matter within the next 6 months. Because COSATU raises it. And you can't say COSATU is sending money to Dubai. Right? I mean, the SACP raises it. Right? And other NGOs raise it. You know? And while the answers are very competent today, I think we should also invite other people in. Maybe some sort of semi-public hearing. Let's have the discussion. Not now in the current terrain, which is so embroiled in smokes and mirrors, right? Let's put it that way. But in a different context, I think we should have it, actually. Some sort of debate sometime early next year. Let's look into it. We'll explore the possibility of that. Having said that, Governor, kindly respond to whatever you can.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you very much to the committee for the confidence we have in the SARB. In the aftermath of the global financial crisis, central bankers had this saying, central banks are the only game in town. All the other aspects of policy were not working, and so everybody said to the central bank, you are so good, do something. And therein lies the problem. Because you see, we are central banks. We are central bankers. We are running these institutions. The impact on the lives of people, we are unelected. And the things that you are asking us to do are things that are going to be forcing us to make public choices that are supposed to be made by elected representatives of our society. And so we must be careful what we ask the Reserve Bank to do, competent as we are. So, this task team on illicit flows, what can we bring to that team? We bring expertise on data on this cross flow. We bring expertise because we see what goes through the banking system. If things do not go through the banking system, we will not see them. On the odd occasion, SARS customs officials
will arrest somebody with a suitcase full of money on the flight to Dubai at Oliver Tambo Airport or out of Durban, out of Kinshasa Airport. If they didn't arrest that person, we wouldn't pick it up through the system, because it's carried in suitcases, and mostly people who are trading in cash. But we also bring other expertise. We know how to follow the money because we understand the financial system. But we don't know how to catch criminals. It's not our competence. And we don't know how to prosecute these criminals. It's not our competence. Somebody else must coordinate this and say to us, give us your analysis, give us the data. We will avail that data. So with all the good intentions and all the confidence you have with us, we will not be able to assume that responsibility. And I can understand the frustration, because you are seeing that the other institutions that are supposed to be doing what they are supposed to do are not doing it. And you're saying, well, you are so good, do something. But we are good at what we do, not what we, society maybe would be wanting us to do. Good as we are, we would not be able that. Honorable Shivambo, this question that you, and you're not asking it for the first time, about why the bank will give you money to pay a house for 30 years for 500,000, and they give you a loan to pay a car for 500,000. Can I just stretch it? And then you ask 500,000 rents to start a business and you will not get the loan. Right? So where are these things coming from? I think they all have to do with an assessment of credit path. If your bank has given you a loan for a house for 30 years, there is nothing that stops you paying it in 5 years. Actually, you will save a lot of money by paying it in 5 years. So what you are raising is an important need for the psyche of South African society to change. I can take it further, because you said a car of 500,000. We're happy to buy a house for 500,000 and pay it for it over 30 years. And we buy a car for R1 million that we are quite happy to pay in 5 years. We've got to change our psyche as society and understand that as a society we're supposed to be building assets. And a car is not an asset. You drive it out of the showroom, try and sell it back to the same showroom, they will take a big haircut on that car. But the house is an asset that you are having, which in most instances will appreciate in value. But even if it doesn't appreciate in value, who cares? You still have your house, right? So it's a very important thing. So we've got to be changing consumer behavior to say that actually this thing can be paid a shorter. Let's think of it. Think of it that you have a house that the bank has given you a mortgage for 30 years. You pay it in 5 years. You know you are able to withdraw the money from that house. You could almost now withdraw that money to go and start a business. So you've built a collateral. But that is not how we think. When the next model of a car comes, I want the new car.
I think that it's more than a consumer behavior issue. It's mostly how the financial products by the banks themselves are structured. It's almost impossible to go and get a 5-year housing loan for whatever amount of it. It doesn't exist, because they don't offer such products. They always insist that if you want to have a housing loan, you must pay over a period of 20 years or 30 years. But if it's a car, it's 5 years, or 72 weeks, or 78 weeks, or something like that. That is one of the things that should be given guidance on. And I'm saying that the consistency of such practices across all the banks has got features of a cartel that sits somewhere and say that when we give housing finance, it must be 20 to 30 years. So that even if you are rejected by Nedbank, you're going to meet the same thing in FNB, you're going to meet the same thing in APSA or Standard Bank. There's no way you can run to. You can't say that at least these ones are going to give me 5 years, these other ones were giving me 20 years. It doesn't exist. There's cartel practices in the mortgage, and vehicle finance, that must be investigated far much closely. I don't think it's just the consumer behavior. It is also how the financial products are structured currently.
I will come back to the cartel behavior. The point I was trying to make is there is no agreement in any mortgage that will stop you paying your mortgage in 5 years, even if you are given a 30-year mortgage. That is all the point I'm trying. I was trying to make. But I can understand why the bank will not lend you money to pay to buy a car over 20 years, because the chances of that car not being there in the next 5 years are very high. So the value of the collateral disappears. They'll give you a mortgage for 30 years for a house, because the house might still be there. But I take your point. And I wish many South Africans could be thinking about paying their mortgages in 5 years, because we will create so much assets in this economy. Kubani, you'll talk about CBA and Discovery. This cartel, I want to understand, this cartel behavior, Honorable Shivam, you talked about it. And by the way, all the banks across the world will give you loans. 30-year mortgage loans in South Africa are a new phenomenon. They came in the aftermath of the global financial crisis in 2008 to try and ease the burdens of South Africans so that people can afford their monthly repayment. Our mortgages had already been 20 years. Across the Atlantic, they used to give mortgages for 30 years, but not only that, they would give you a mortgage which are called interest-only mortgages. So you just repay the interest and you keep on owing the bank, and we unfortunately have not had those kinds of practices. That said, cartel behavior, if can be proven and if it exists, is abhorrible and have got to be nipped. The legislation that you talk about, the Financial Sector Regulations Bill, was called Twin Peaks legislation. And the question that was asked was, well, there is a third peak that is missing, and that third peak is competition. Well, it is in this committee where you know there were heated debates about whether the NCR should come into one of the peaks. We were not, if there could be such contestations about the NCR, we were not about to even try it about the Competition Commission. But there is a reason why the Competition Commission has to be outside of this thing. Because you want the Competition Commission to investigate more than the financial sector. They must investigate collusive behavior in the construction sector, in the food sector, and so forth. And actually today, our biggest ally as the Reserve Bank in the fight against inflation is the Competition Commission. Because they find all of these price-fixing behaviors and they try and crack them. And we actually need to be, all of us, be throwing the weight behind the Competition Commission. Because if we are to ever have sustainably low inflation, you have got to make sure that you have got functioning markets, and you are going to have to crack this this cartel behavior. So we are at one on the cartel thing. I have dealt with this thing. Could I deal with the stuff? And then, Francois, you are going to deal with the guarantee given to Abel.
Chair, a company called Time, TYME, Take Your Money Everywhere, which is majority owned by Commonwealth Bank of Australia, has been given a banking license. They also have a local BEE partner. Discovery Bank, their Section 13 license expires, I think, on the 24th of October, so before then they have to apply for a Section 17 license. Chair, two more points. The one, it's the final licensing phase. The Section 13 license is a provisional license valid for a year. Chair, a lot of the issues that Mr. Shivambo raises are market conduct issues. And I think one of the strengths of the Twin Peaks framework is to create a dedicated market conduct regulator. Because not just in South Africa, but historically, central banks have been too soft on market conduct issues. In South Africa as well. And I think the establishment of a dedicated market conduct regulator outside the central bank is a positive development. And they must be as tough as we are. We would be more than willing to join any task force to cooperate on illicit financial flows. And Chair, I will send you the paragraph on the multidimensional nature of transformation.
Oh, sorry.
The Chair, the Governor asked me to respond to the question of the guarantee.
Oh, yeah.
You would recall that we've put a guarantee in place. At this stage, we've got a fairly high degree of confidence that the guarantee will not be called upon. Even if it had to be called, we as the central bank, in terms of our legislation, may not grant assistance unless there's collateral. So whatever we have made available, either in terms of support or the guarantee, would be collateralized. But at this stage, based on the information, we have a fairly high degree of confidence that the guarantee will not be called on.
The last thing. To say what Deputy Governor Naidoo didn't say about the CBA and Discover. That's Commonwealth Bank of Australia. They came and bought a South African fintech company. So just a fintech company in South Africa that was minding its business, and this foreign bank looked at the capability of this fintech company and decided that we will buy this company and apply for a banking license. Both of those licenses are all technology driven. So no, so the, in the space, things will be broken, but they are going to be broken by technology. You're not going to break them by bricks and mortar. I don't know when you last went to a branch. I went for the first time this year in 10 years. And I got surprised because said, how could we help you? And they told me, said, you see, go to that terminal. What do you want to do? Press on this menu here and then go on. So you are no longer serviced by people in the bank. You are serviced by a machine. So and technology is going to break this thing. I don't know if you have seen this thing that one South African bank said that, okay, if you are banking on your app, it's data free. And then they all started to negotiate the same thing. And then we could look at this and say, did they sit somewhere and say that we must now give free data? But the truth of the matter is that if one gives free data, if the others don't, everybody will go there. So they all move immediately to then start giving free data. Just to finish off, Chair, the debate about the Reserve Bank in South Africa, I don't think that we should be looking at this and think that there is something wrong with us South Africans debating the role of central banks. And the reason I gave the example of the central banks in the global, in the advanced economies where they were saying they were the only game in town and they started to be this thing. These institutions will always, there will always be a contestation in society about them. But we must be very careful that contestation has got to be a genuine contestation about the roles the institutions play. And even in the build-up to the writing of our constitution, there was contestation about what actually eventually goes into the constitution. Correctly so. We are a constitutional democracy, and the constitutional court was asked to pronounce on these things. So there's going to have to be changes. Let us have these things. I mean, I was very clear that if there is going to be a debate about monetary policy, we must move on the basis of common information and common facts. In monetary policy, we say, you are entitled to your own opinion, but you are not entitled to your own facts. You are not entitled to your own facts. We must move on the basis of the same facts. And so these debates are taking place in the U.S. now. They might cost the chair of the Fed her job because the president holds a different view and others hold different views. There was a big debate. You say you ask us to do all of these things. The Bank of England innocently decided that as a central bank they must prepare themselves in case Brexit happens, and they said the following risks must be taken. Before they knew it, their governor was being attacked to say that he tried to promote a particular view. So you will see these contestations will take place in society. There is something this country has always been good at. It has been our ability to structure a civilized national dialogue. And it is that strength that we have got to be playing into when we have to debate this thing. In closing, Chair, of all the things that are currently bothering us, that are broken and that must be fixed. Is changing the mandate of the Reserve Bank the most important one at this stage?
I'm glad you said the things you said in your last point, because I was going to say that before it's misunderstood. We are saying that it may also be in the interest of the Reserve Bank and those of us who are committed to its independence and its resilience and its servicing the people as a whole, that the debate might take place, because the information you're giving, just one little example, is of one chairperson, who's a very sophisticated guy of a province, saying to me, I wish I was there, I'm learning so much by serving it. So I don't think we want a debate that's going to end up like, you know, shaking, let's say, the investors and undermining the country's developmental goals. And so it'd be a measured, I said, like a peri public hearing of a certain sort. I don't know. We're exploring that possibility. There may not be a need for it. But I think it's better to have a dialogue. You spoke of a civilized dialogue. That is a nice way of saying it. Right? So we can look into that. We'll engage with you, and the committee will engage within itself. The next quick thing I wanted to say was, before we part, one is Tandi is not well, so she did tender an apology, and Pinky is in some IPU, International Parliamentary Union, engagement. Then the next thing to say is that, Floyd, you know this point you made about the way mortgages and loans are structured, vehicle financing. And if you want to say something for the report, I think you should give us a paragraph there. The thing that strikes me, as I heard you again now as a team, is that, you know, given the gravity of the crisis around IFS, right, illicit financial flows and so on, the fact that the state hasn't itself, and has to wait for Parliament, proposed an interministerial committee, the fact that the institutions there, SARS, yourselves, Treasury, the Department, hasn't proposed what Floyd says, is an obvious thing to do, a task force, he calls it, whatever you want to call it, an interinstitutional structure. The fact that it hasn't come from there is extremely worrying, given where we are. But we're not going to relent on this. Starting from now, I'm going to, on behalf of this committee, pursue the minister vigorously. And we're going to ask questions in Parliament as the ANC, what is happening about this and so on. The question we also want to alert you that we've raised when the Reserve Bank was here the last time on IFS is, yes, you hand over matters to the police, the hawks and so on, and needless to say, they do nothing. Sometimes I think it's because they don't want to do anything, because of who the people are you're accusing. Sometimes I think they would like to do something, but they don't have the capacity and the expertise. In the established industrialized countries as well, I went to a conference last December, where in the UK, where, you know, people in Europe were saying, our police, our prosecutors just don't have the expertise. Each time these people are doing these wrong things, draw on powerful like PwC and whoever they draw, they're technically one step ahead or two steps ahead of us. But we would like you, please, to follow up, ask the police, what are you doing about these matters? We said to SARS, it's not enough just to do it. We want to know, are you following up? Are you asking them? It's, you're putting pressure because you know the cases you've raised with them. We are hauling them here, and that's the correct word, on the 29th. And that's why I would like concrete stuff, you know, where we separate out issues and say, okay, these things you can't answer in this meeting, and so on. So the next thing I want to repeat, the new point you've raised for me at least, I don't know, Zakhele is very sharp and Antonia is also, maybe they picked it up. You see, what you're saying, which didn't come out strongly in the hearings, unless, you know, if you're hearing all the time, but with Joan, but you get distracted by things, maybe it was raised there. But the point that I would like members to be aware of is one side of struggle to demonopolize is technology, the extent to which new, see, one of the things that's worrying us, you introducing the government is all this rigorous and vigorous legislation, right? And the black entrants who are emerging entrants or would-be entrants come in and say, yeah, that's fine. But each time you introduce something and you uplift the standards or whatever, it means it makes it less possible for us to enter the market. And we said, well, the needs of an emerging black entrepreneurial class must be represented by Parliament. but balanced out with the need of the depositors and the policyholders, or often the lower strata, poorer income people who lose out disproportionately. So finding that balance is something we're pleading with everybody, not least Treasury, Momoniat, and the team that comes here. So on technology, I think we should do some work around that, Zakela, Antonia. How will technology assist, and where is technology? I know there's a thing called FinTech, eh? There's a new area that I discovered by accident at some conference. All right, then finally, we want to take this opportunity, Governor, of thanking you very much and your team for the very competent replies and the very useful comments you've made. And just remind members, finally, that we are here on Friday at 9:30 with the SAA. And just, it's an internal matter, you can leave, but we're about to finish. I'm told by Alan and Tevovo, is that right, we've got volumes and volumes of documentation. Right. Now I want to see what the DA and other parties are going to do with that. Because... Sorry? All right, fine. But what I mean is you've given it... We suggested that give one or two copies to each party, because it's how many? It's running thousands of pages.
Yeah, thousands of pages.
How many pages? 1,000 pages. I don't think, can I get consensus on this, colleagues, that the other, the parties all get one each, maybe the ANC gets two, right? And then that's done. Okay, all right. And is there anything else, members? No, thank you all.
On the Bofors laptop. Copies from this back. Welcome.